You're listening to Over the Top, a Great War podcast. I'm your host, Richard Cantu. Please join me as I talk about World War I history and preserve the stories from the soldiers who lived through it. Welcome back, folks. This is episode 63, and this is going to be part one of my Verdun series, and we're now in 1916. Let's see what's today. Today is December 28th. I wanted to wish you all a merry late Christmas. I hope yours was really good. I know mine was good. A couple days off work is always nice. So everybody was happy, makes me happy, and it was a merry Christmas. I'll just say that. This is going to be a long episode, and to start out Verdun part one, it's going to be a little different maybe than what you think. So I'm just going to jump right into this because, again, I think this is going to be a long episode from what I'm anticipating. Okay. Let's see. Before I started this podcast, the battle I enjoy discussing and learning about the most regarding the Great War was Verdun. So naturally, I've been pretty anxious to get the Verdun series started. The Verdun we see today, with the River Meuse's water flowing through the city, with Port Chausse greeting you as you enter the city, there's this sort of romance to the city. My wife and I had a small picnic along the river, and it was everything that I could have expected from a small town in the Meuse department, historically known as the Lorraine region. It's green, hilly, beautiful. Kind of a small town vibe. But this wasn't the same Verdun people witnessed in 1916. Verdun transformed into Dante's Inferno as the Great War rolled into it. This beautiful city that we see today and the region surrounding it was pure carnage. The Battle of Verdun is the epitome of hell. It takes everything we've learned from trench warfare, gas attacks, hellish artillery bombardments, mayhem, death, destruction, suffering, and rolls it up into one title, the Battle of Verdun. Several years ago, a gentleman named Dan Carlin put together a podcast series called Blueprint for Armageddon. It was all about Verdun. And not a fairy tale by any means. Early on in his series, he said if there was a time and place in history you didn't want to be, for him, it would be Verdun, 1916. And I would have to agree with him because it was that bad. And just about every French soldier in 1916 had to do a rotation in Verdun. The Poilus were roughly given less than a 50% chance of survival. And there's been a lot of devastating wars and events in human history to where if you did have a time machine, you'd need to program a lot of times in history to never populate. You know, make sure the flux capacitor powered vehicle knows not to stop there, if you get what I mean. So for Verdun to stand out as being one of the world's most devastating battles, it's got to be pretty bad. However, before I can even begin to talk about this battle, I first have to take a step back in time because the German and French animosity didn't start in the summer of 1914. We really need to go back and take a look at the Franco-Prussian War, which should really be called the Franco-German War because the Prussians weren't the only ones fighting the French. But history knows it as the Franco-Prussian War, so I'll call it that. And even before I can even get into that war, I need to go back even further. Much further. Middle Ages further. So my Verdun series part one and two are going to cover historical events that led to the aggression between the two nations before the Great War started. I mean, I guess I could have spoken about the Franco-Prussian War prior to when I started talking about the actual Great War kicking off. I mean, months and months ago, probably when I first started this podcast. But if you don't know already, Verdun, the Franco-Prussian War, Alsace-Lorraine, it's all intertwined like a web. So I always felt it would be appropriate to discuss this right before I start talking about the Battle of Verdun. I feel it's a very important piece to the puzzle. So let me get into this because, again, I feel like this is going to be a long one. Back to the Middle Ages. In the early 9th century, Charlemagne the Great expanded the Frankish Empire, modern-day France, into Germany, Switzerland, parts of northern Italy, Austria, the Balkans, Hungary, the Czech Republic, Spain, and the Low Countries, which we know as Belgium and the Netherlands. Now, that's a vast amount of territory Charlemagne ruled over. He united most of Central and Western Europe for the first time since the fall of the Roman Empire. He became known as the Father of Europe, among other names given to him during his reign. But trouble prevailed after his death due to his heirs' inability to agree upon the successor to the throne. By the mid-9th century, Charlemagne's empire had split into three sections after a civil war between his grandsons broke out. This was the aftermath of the Treaty of Verdun in 843. The grandsons formed West Francia, Middle Francia, and East Francia between themselves. None was willing to hand the pie over. They were going to divide it up. In doing so, naturally greed or lust for more power comes with the title of holding a throne. Middle Francia was the most fragile between the three. It lacked solid structure. Because of this, East and West Francia began competing for parts of its territories. One in particular, and probably the most important because it's directly related to the series, the Alsace and Lorraine territory. Over the next couple centuries following the death of Charlemagne, the East and West evolved into more of what we know as Germany and France. Now, the list of rulers who held the title King of Germany is long. But one in particular is worth noting, Otto the First, or better known as Otto the Great. Otto, I believe, was a descendant of Charlemagne. I've read two parts. I've read he was and I read he wasn't. I think he was. Either way, he managed to revive the Holy Roman Empire in 1962. When I get these three-digit numbers, this gets a little hard. In 962, after he was crowned a Holy Roman Emperor, Charlemagne was crowned a Roman Emperor in the year 800 by Pope Leo III. By the late 15th century, the German nation became known as the Holy Roman Empire of the German Nations. Over the years in the 12th century, for the Franks, they became the French, and their nation became France. Pretty straightforward for now. Much like the Holy Roman Empire of the German nations, the strength of the king's rule in France was measured by his competence, not like today's jackasses who's measured by their incompetence. But even more important for France, the French transformed its kingdom into an absolute monarchy by the 16th century. And in doing so, the French began to drop their local identities and adopted the identity of just being French. This created unification. It was the opposite for the Germans. They began to weaken because they weren't as tightly knit for now. There were too many Germanic identities butting heads. Because of this, the Holy Roman Empire became part of the Habsburg monarchy. And there's so much more to the story, to this history. You can go really deep into this, but for sake of time and to stay on track, it's best just to know they became part of the Habsburgs. Along with the addition of the Holy Roman Empire, the Habsburg monarchy also ruled through Austria, Hungary, parts of Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Slovenia, Croatia, Spain, and Portugal, along with their colonial territories across the globe. The Habsburgs were a pretty big deal at this point in time. Problem for the Habs, the Holy Roman Empire began to crack. Its territories began to fracture off into smaller duchies. Not the type of duchy you roll up and smoke, but a territory duchy. The Holy Roman Empire realistically began its decline when the 30 Years' War from 1618 to 1648 began, and the German territories became the battlefield. This remains one of the longest and most brutal wars in Europe's history. It was fought by various nations for various reasons, including religion, dynasty, territory, and commercial rivalry. When it ended with the Treaty of Westphalia, the map of Europe drastically changed. Alsace and Lorraine were given to France. By the 17th century, France was at the height of its power under the rule of Louis XIV. They, meaning he, wanted to expand, but not necessarily take on a worthy foe such as the Habsburgs. Instead, they viewed Germany as a weaker, more vulnerable foe to take on. And this meant expansion to the east, Alsace and Lorraine being the highest priced territory to fight over. What makes this region so sought after? Is it the beauty of the region? Was it the iron deposits creating metal production and trade? Is it because the territory borders Germany and Switzerland and France? Or is it just cursed? And I say cursed because whatever it has that draws people to want to fight over it must be powerful, because people have been fighting over it for centuries. The late chef, writer, and TV host Anthony Bourdain took his life there. Not that it has anything to do with history, but worth mentioning. Numerous wars were fought throughout the 17th and 18th century to gain control over the two regions. It swapped hands many times between the Habsburgs and the French. After Louis XIV's death, France sort of went into a downward spiral. His heirs lost some costly wars, such as the Seven Years' War between 1756 and 1763. By the way, I know history has given the term World War I to the Great War, but if you think about it, in reality, this wasn't technically the First World War. The Seven Years' War and even the Nine Years' War turned into a global conflict that spread as far as the Americas. Now, the Seven Years' War was a war waged by the French towards the British. The French actually allied up with the Habsburgs, while the British allied up with the rising Germanic state in the east, the Prussians. Prussia's rise to power came when it passed into the hands of the Hohenzollern dynasty. The Hohenzollern dynasty held other estates such as Brandenburg and Berlin. In 1657, Prussia gained its independence from the Polish crown, giving free rein to the Hohenzollerns. And again, you can go deep into this, but I'm trying to keep this as simple as possible. Over the next several decades following its independence from Poland, Prussia began to expand its military might. Around 1740, they'd become strong enough to challenge the Habsburgs. Prussia waged two small wars, which were part of a larger Europe conflict. The War of the Austrian Succession between 1740 and 1748. During this war, Prussia partnered up with the French, while the Habs teamed up with the Brits. When the Seven Years' War came along, starting in 1756, but actually the French and Indian War began in 1754, either way, it went on until the Treaty of Paris in 1763. But the allegiances changed during this war. Prussia sided with the British, and the Habs teamed up with their bitter enemy, the French. Prussia became the dominant German state, colliding with France. By the later part of the 18th century, France and Germany were foes, and not only considered enemies, but opposites. Germany, or Prussia, to be more precise, was on the rise and expanding, while France was on the decline, with many social issues tearing up the nation, resulting in the French Revolution. Immediately following the treatment of Louis XIV, which was the revolutionaries chopping off his head, the Habsburgs and Prussia reacted by issuing stern threats to the revolutionaries. This ultimately led to more war. To have one of their own beheaded by the common folks, they just couldn't accept this kind of behavior. They would not stand for this, mainly because revolutionary ideas and actions could lead to their demise as well. So, after the death of Louis, France went to war with Spain, Portugal, and the British. By 1795, Prussia had enough and signed a separate peace agreement with the French. The Habs allied up with the British and pushed on. The battlefields were in northern Italy and the territories of the Holy Roman Empire. War waged on, destruction ensued, many lives were lost. The Habs and British finally had enough, both asking for peace. By 1802, France emerged from the inferno as the victor from this decade-long war. However, something else emerged from the ashes of this. Napoleon. He rose to power after seizing control of the Republic through a coup d'etat in 1799. Yes, that little guy gained control of France. He formed a consulate and by 1800 became the first consul of France. Little Bonaparte earned the respect and support from the soldiers and the people of France with his reputation as being a well-respected officer during the French Revolution. It was shortly after he became the consul that he crowned himself the emperor in 1804. And do you know where he was crowned? That's right, Notre Dame de Paris. It's rumored he snatched the crown from Pope Pius, crowned himself, displaying the rejection of authority of the pontiff. Just a fun fact. Maybe, is it Pius or Pius? I don't know. Napoleon had a complex. He wanted a fight, and his mind was set on expanding France. He led a European-wide offensive. Britain, Russia, and the Habs, even the Naples, and even Sweden formed a coalition against France in 1803 to contain him. The war on land was going in Napoleon's favor with the victory over Russia and Austria at Austerlitz in 1805. This forced the Habsburgs to withdraw from the coalition to seek out peace with France. More German states would follow the Habs peace deal in 1806, which formed the Confederation of the Rhine. This is what historians call the final dissolution of the Holy Roman Empire. However, the HRE really wasn't much prior to this. German states were operating independently, if not part of Prussia. France at this point had power over Germany. The Napoleonic Wars continued on for several years. Both Emperor Francis II of Austria and Prussia attempted to challenge France, yet both were defeated multiple times, resulting in loss of territories. Napoleon took western parts of Prussia and formed the Kingdom of Westphalia. Austria lost Carinthia, Carniola, and in its Adriatic ports, and Galicia. Now, in most cases, as a result of expanding your army over a vast amount of territory in a rather short period of time, you'll begin to thin the herd. This is what happened. The French army stretched itself out thin, losing power, ultimately suffering some losses. Next, many of the Germanic allies began to abandon Napoleon. After the Battle of Leipzig in 1813, many stepped away from the Confederation of the Rhine. Eventually, it crumbled. Napoleon suffered his final defeat in 1815 at the Battle of Waterloo, finally bringing peace to Europe. This resulted in the Congress of Vienna in 1815. The Congress of Vienna included all major nations, which included France, now under the rule of the old Bourbon dynasty. Here, they would come up with a long-term peace plan and resize the powers. Once again, a lot more to it than that. It's fascinating, and I encourage you to read about it. What's important to this is the Holy Roman Empire wasn't reestablished. Instead, a new German Confederation was formed covering most of the former HRE. It was made up of over 40 independent entities in a loose alliance under Austria's guidance. So there was this struggle of who was going to rule over Germany. Was it going to be the Prussians or was it going to be the Austrians? Rumors of a German unification began to spread. Prussians were eager for unification, while this didn't really sit well for Austria. Prussia created a customs union in 1818 called the Zollverein. It was a commercial alliance that helped with the growth of German and Prussian industries and economy. They made sure to keep Austria out of it. This strengthened the economic expansion of the Germanic states, which resulted in a rapid industrialization in the 1840s. This was fueling the need for a German unification. France was going through ups and downs. They had a new revolution resulting in the Second Republic. Louis Napoleon Bonaparte, Napoleon's nephew, emerged as the president of all the people. He was actually the first president of France. He's also referred to as Napoleon III. Prussia also experienced uprisings, mainly to promote unification, along with ideas for a next step to better their lives. By 1849, this was broken by the royals through immense violence. But this signaled for support of a unified Germany. The Habsburgs were experiencing a series of uprisings from just about anyone who wasn't Germanic. The crisis was too much for the emperor named Ferdinand I, so he abdicated in favor of his more liberal nephew, Franz Joseph. The Habsburg Empire was really going through its own sort of civil war at this time. There were several rebellions and different nationalities that clashed with one another. Peace was finally restored, but now the Austro-Prussian rivalry was beginning to heat up. By 1852, Napoleon III decided to promote himself from president to emperor, becoming Emperor Napoleon III. This transformed France back into an empire. And once again, France, or more accurately, Napoleon III, looked to become a dominant force in Europe. Much like his uncle, he had a grand vision of expanding France's power through Europe. This would ultimately take them right down Prussia's lane. He should be given credit for the growth in economics and in industrialization during his early years. Ultimately, this is what allowed him to go forth with the interference in foreign affairs. He first expanded the French colonies in Indochina and Africa. France gained control over Algeria and made a strong position in China. He also built up the merchant navy, which at the time became the second most largest. He commissioned the grand reconstruction of Paris. He expanded the railway system through the nation and was credited with modernizing the banking system. He promoted the construction of the Suez Canal and established modern agriculture, which ended famine in France and resulted in agriculture exporting. He did some good things. He did have some success. But unfortunately, his failures seemed to always shine over the rest. First was the Crimean War between 1854 and 1856, for instance, siding with the British and Ottoman Empire against the Imperial Russians. The result had no gains, only pure expenditure to fight in the war. His poor diplomatic relations in North America almost dragged France into the U.S. Civil War. His attempt to secure Mexico completely failed. The expedition force sent in 1861 fought against the Mexicans for several years before defeated in 1867. The French ruler in Mexico, Emperor Maximilian, was abandoned after the French withdrew, and he was captured by Juarez's forces, then executed by a firing squad. France was humiliated and Napoleon III lost a lot of supporters. Again, yeah, he did some good things at first, but instead of bringing peace to France, he brought wars that resulted in loss of life and finances. In a way, it's like Turkey before entering the Great War. They were doing good. Their economy was booming, but war brought them down. Very similar, in my opinion. Prussia was also going through a sort of roller coaster of events. Frederick Wilhelm IV led them through a rough patch in the 1850s. He experienced political instability caused by a revolution in 1848. However, the economy and industry continued to expand. They suffered a military loss against Denmark in the First Schleswig War between 1848 and 1851. They didn't fare so well or kind of looked down upon during the Crimean War in 1854 and 1856 and the Italian War of 1859. Their status as a European power was really losing its credit. These losses didn't sit well with Frederick's younger brother, Wilhelm, who became a regent when the king suffered a stroke. Wilhelm, or William, as some know him, was planned to return Prussia to its former glory through military might. And by the way, Wilhelm, this would be Kaiser Wilhelm's grandfather. Well, William, whatever you want to call him, officially became king after his brother's death in 1861 and set forth to restore military order. And this did cause some upheavals within the political powers of Prussia. At one point, King Wilhelm I thought about abdicating, but instead appointed Otto von Bismarck as the prime minister in September of 1862. This was a turning point for Prussia. Bismarck was recommended to Wilhelm by Minister of War Albrecht von Roon. Bismarck proved his qualities as he outmaneuvered opponents of the military reform. Wilhelm was an old general who believed that the power of a nation lies within its military. Bismarck believed that Prussia's ultimate goal must be unification of Germany through blood and iron. The Prussian Chief of Staff, Field Marshal Helmuth von Moltke, personally led the reorganization and restructuring of the Prussian forces. Moltke was in favor of expanding the military in numbers, purchasing more advanced weapons, improving their communications with better technology, training on mobilization for effectiveness, and creating a professional officer corps. By 1864, Prussia, under Bismarck's leadership, transformed its military into a powerful house, just waiting to show their capabilities. Denmark would be that one to show their military might towards. It was in retaliation for what happened during the First Schleswig War. The new Danish monarch issued a new constitution that proclaimed Schleswig as an integral part of the Danish crown. This violated the peace treaty from the First War in the 1850s. This is all Bismarck needed to launch a new campaign, the Second Schleswig War of 1864. It was like music to his ears. On a map today, this would be Germany's northernmost region. Hamburg to the south, you have Lübeck to the east, and Flensburg to the north. Flensburg? Yeah, I said that right. Flensburg to the north. This was fuel to bring the German people together. He even included the Austrians to join the fight. Wasn't a long war. With the combined German and Austrian troops, they outnumbered and outgunned the Danish. By mid-1864, they had conquered nearly all of Denmark, and by October, a peace treaty had been signed. Austria gained Holstein and Prussia gained Schleswig. But most importantly, Prussia got to show off its military strength. This was not the same military that fought during the first Schleswig War. Sorry, some of this is kind of tongue-twisting. After this new treaty was signed and Austria and Prussia were finished dividing up Denmark, it created tension between the two. Some historians believe this was part of Bismarck's grand design, but that's a debate we're definitely not going to solve on this podcast. What I can tell you for sure is by 1866, tensions had risen to the point where Prussia accused Austria of breaching their joint sovereignty by allowing Holstein to organize an assembly. The two went back and forth exchanging accusations, resulting in both fishing in the sea for allies. Bismarck secured an alliance with Italy, while Austria secured alliances with Germanic states, still hanging on a limb. However, these states did fear the Prussian military at this point. The two nations began to mobilize their troops at the borders. War seemed imminent. Napoleon III was watching closely from the side with interest to see how this would play out. He met with Bismarck in 1865 and assured him that France would stay neutral in case this war broke out. Neutrality with France was good with Bismarck. He needed them to stay away for now. I don't think Bismarck was really interested in a war with France at this certain point in time. His main goal was to unify all of Germany. This wasn't a good time to go to war with France. By 1866, Prussia and Austria were prepared to duke it out. By June, Prussia announced their current agreement with Austria over Denmark territory, that it was voided out. And so, Bismarck invaded Holstein. Prussia then declared that the German Confederation was dissolved and invaded Saxony, Hesse, and Hanover. Italy then declared war on Austria. By the way, I'm going to veer from the path for a moment. My wife wants to take my stepson to Germany after he graduates next year. She asked where we should take him to. Germany remains one of my favorite countries in Europe, mainly because I deployed there in the military on several occasions pre-9/11. I cross-trained with the Fallschirmjäger, jumped with them on several occasions, getting my German jump wings. Still got my card and certification, by the way, somewhere in my files. There's a lot of history there for me. It's personal. And I think that's why I love Germany so much. But outside of me going for the military, I've also been there as a civilian. I mean, there's so much to see and do. Much like my last episode where I recommended sites to visit for the Western Front, I can tell you about the great places to see in Deutschland, and it goes on and on. Anyway, she wants us to go for something like 12 or 14 days, but also wants to take her to Paris. And I keep telling her, you need the full 12 to 14 days in Germany just to get a good experience. And even then, there's no possible chance of visiting all the amazing cities. There's just too much to see and do. One city I've never visited is Berlin, so this is a must for me. But all these cities that I'm naming in this episode are worth taking a trip to see. Germany is absolutely amazing, and in my opinion, has the best beer in the world. Anywho, I can get really sidetracked with that topic, so let me get back. Prussia defeated the Hanoverian forces by the end of June, then amassed troops near Moravia, where the Austrians had been gathering its troops. The two then fought at what is known as the Battle of Königgrätz on July 3rd. The Prussians had technological and tactical supremacy, leaving the Austrian army running in its tracks. As Prussia advanced through the Czech Republic and Slovakia, they defeated Saxon and Bavarian troops. The Austrians knew they were no match for the new Prussian military. They requested peace on July 22nd, bringing the war to an end, which lasted just about 7 weeks. On August 12th, the Italians ended their campaign as well. It was Bismarck's position to capitalize on this war. He still had to play the role of a diplomatic politician. He had an agenda and knew if Prussia pushed too far, Russia and France would jump in, which could have led to the collapse of his master plan. Plus, he wanted to avoid Austria and the other lingering Germanic states from retaliating in the future because of some lost territory. He knew when to call it quits for this. And in late August, peace was agreed upon. Through this, Prussia annexed Schleswig, Holstein, Hanover, Hesse Cassel, Nassau, and Frankfurt. The rest of the Germanic northern states were organized into the North German Confederation, which Prussia basically controlled their military and foreign relations. They were really just a stone throw away from also being annexed by Prussia. France intervened during this peace treaty. To prevent further unification of Germanic states under Prussia, Napoleon demanded from Bismarck for the independence of Saxony, Bavaria, Württemberg, Baden, and Hesse-Darmstadt. Prussia had increased its size in a short period of time. This was a threat to Napoleon. If Prussia was to spread to southern Germany, it would boost their population and economy. Naturally, this would continue to strengthen the Prussian military. If they did this, they could easily flank French defenses. Napoleon's goal was to prevent this. His response was to try and purchase Luxembourg from the Netherlands. Bismarck at first wasn't opposed to this if France agreed to stay neutral. However, by early 1867, Bismarck and Prussia were in a position to start opposing such ideas, especially from Napoleon. And I think it was at this point Bismarck was looking at Napoleon and saying, "Who the hell is this guy to demand anything? We're more powerful." Bismarck was feeling confident with his military and objected to such a proposal with no concerns of a French reaction or retaliation. Bismarck threatened France with war if France went through with the deal. A conference of major powers was held in London, resulting in the independence of Luxembourg by the nations. Needless to say, this created major tension between France and Prussia, but both weren't ready to take that step towards war. France knew it had to build up and modernize its military if they wanted to fight with Prussia. Bismarck was worried that another war could result in the unification of other European powers to deal with Prussia. So he decided to sit back, buy some time, continue to strengthen his force, and let France decide the next move. And during this time, he would use his foreign diplomatic skills to persuade other powers not to ally or pony up with Napoleon. And this was a smart decision on Bismarck's part. Sometimes the best approach is to walk, not run. In 1868, Bismarck formed an all-German customs parliament called the Zollparlament, strengthening Prussia's ties with southern German states. This upset Napoleon, who reminded Bismarck of the southern states' independence from Prussia. The plan was falling in place for Bismarck, and he basically told Napoleon to pound sand. The tension was rising, and a possible French attack only increased the need for unification between the German people, especially in the southern states. The two nations were walking on a thin piece of ice. They just needed that one thing to cause the full rupture, sending them into war. Napoleon appointed Duke de Gramont, Antoine Agernaud Gramont, kind of confusing, as the Minister of Foreign Relations. He was the 10th Duke of Gramont, which probably doesn't matter much, but the first Duke of Gramont was appointed by Louis XIV back in 1643. Antoine also was one of the few survivors of the SS Arctic, an American transatlantic paddle steamer, which sank in 1854 after colliding with a French vessel off the coast of Newfoundland. He was observed leaping from the ship into the last remaining lifeboat. Historians believe there were around 400 passengers and that only 88 survived. I believe all the women and children on board perished. And it's kind of odd that they say estimate the number of on board were 400, but I guess it's because they didn't really take an accurate head count back then. A lot of the lower class just kind of got put on the ship. We've all seen Titanic, come on. Anywho, Gramont was hell-bent on going to war with Prussia. He wanted to teach them a lesson not to mess with French foreign affairs. he and the prime minister, along with Napoleon, agreed that the next disrespectful act by the Prussia towards France would mean game on. Here's where the plot really begins to thicken. The Spanish Parliament offered their crown to Leopold Hohenzollern, Wilhelm's cousin. But both Leopold and Wilhelm rejected it, seeing Spain as too unstable at this point. However, in May of 1870, Bismarck persuaded Leopold's father to accept the crown in his name. A few weeks later, Leopold decided he would take it after all. By early July, the news of this reached France, prompting an immediate response. And rightfully so, because if the Spanish crown would have gone to the Hohenzollern dynasty, France literally would have been encircled. However, Emperor Wilhelm didn't want to come off as an instigator. He discussed this with Leopold and his father, and they ultimately rejected the offer to take the Spanish crown on July 11th. But Grammont wasn't satisfied with this rejection. He wanted in every way to humiliate Prussia if he couldn't fight them in war. Also, by this point, the citizens of France were also calling for war with Prussia. Grammont sent a telegram to the French ambassador in Prussia demanding a written renunciation from Emperor Wilhelm, as well as a pledge that Prussia would never reach for the Spanish crown. The French ambassador met with Wilhelm on July 13th at Bad Ems. Here, Wilhelm listened to the demands from the ambassador, then abruptly walked away, saying nothing. Word of Wilhelm's reaction to the ambassador reached Bismarck, and he saw an opportunity. He rewrote the events in his so-called own version, making it sound like Wilhelm refused the ambassador an audience with complete disrespect. You could say this was part fact and part fiction, depending on how you look at it. Bismarck then circulated his own version across European newspapers. The so-called Ems Dispatch, or sometimes called the Ems Telegram, was that event which would rupture the thin ice both nations were walking on. The newspapers went public with a telegram on July 14th, a kick in the face to France because this fell on Bastille Day. The next day, France ordered mobilization. And on July 19th, France declared war on Prussia. This was the start of the Franco-Prussian War. All right, folks, that's going to be it for this episode. Part two of the Verdun series will kick off with the actual Franco-Prussian War. And then part three, I should probably be actually getting into the Battle of Verdun. I hope you enjoyed this. It's really all intertwined like a web, like I said. And this all goes back to the Alsace-Lorraine, which you're really going to see in the Treaty of the Franco-Prussian War next. They just fought for it century after century. Again, I ask, why is it so special? But I'll lead you to your own conclusion on that. Anywho, again, folks, I hope you all had a wonderful Christmas. I wish you all a happy new year. Thank you for your continued support of the show. As always, you fans are the best. Again, I hope you enjoyed the last episode with the questions and answers. The more you guys send me, the more I'll do that. I thought it was really fun. I really enjoyed that. Until the next episode, take care, everybody.